This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. This is a song about Ed Johnson. In 1906, Johnson, a young black man, was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted of a crime he did not commit here in Chattanooga. His case reached the United States Supreme Court, which issued a stay of execution, but a violent mob took the law into its own hands and lynched him on the Walnut Street Bridge. From his arrest through his trial to the final moments of his life, Ed Johnson said again and again, "I am an innocent man." We bring you a series of conversations with members of the Ed Johnson Project about his story from more than a century ago and the memorial in this century at the south end of the bridge where his life ended. This hour, we hear from the Project's Mary Ann Martin and from Judge Neil Thomas, whose great uncle, WGM Will Thomas, was one of the defense lawyers at Johnson's trial. The story begins in Chattanooga's St. Elmo neighborhood on the night of Monday, January 23, 1906. Nevada Taylor, a young white woman, arrives at Cemetery Station and begins walking the 2.5 blocks to her home. Mary Ann, Neil, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
We want to begin with what we know happened on January 23rd, 1906, the evening of January 23rd, 1906. Streetlights were few and far between, especially down in St. Elmo.
Yes. You know, I don't know if anyone has ever walked that part of town. This is right in front of the Forest Cemetery. And as we were working on the film on this, we shot in that area quite a bit. And it's just really interesting, puts you back into that place because it's still fairly deserted, fairly quiet as you walk that sidewalk. Nevada Taylor, who worked downtown, took a streetcar home around 6 o'clock in January 23rd, as you mentioned, would have been probably almost completely dark or close to dark and just walking along. And suddenly, you know, as she and her father lived and some of her siblings lived in a small cottage within the cemetery, her father was a groundskeeper there. And she was going home from work. As she walked, she heard footsteps behind her. And you just really have to, when you're in that area and walking that sidewalk, you just have to think about what that must have felt like for her as a young woman coming home from work after dark at night.
And as she approached that cemetery gate, she felt her throat grab from behind and a voice say, "If you scream, I will kill you." And this was an attack that left her unconscious. It lasted only 10 minutes. She was assaulted and she was raped. And then when she regained consciousness, she walked the 100 yards to her home and told her father the attack. Her father called Sheriff Joseph Shipp, who gathered bloodhounds and deputies, then rushed off to the Taylor home. And a doctor soon arrived to examine Nevada Taylor and confirmed that she had been raped. When the sheriff asked Nevada Taylor what she could remember, she couldn't recall much, could she?
My understanding is no. And the only thing she was able to state was that she thought a strap had been put around her neck.
And then we turn to Will Hixon, who would testify against Ed Johnson at his trial.
Geographically, Mary Ann, I'm not sure I'm correct in this, but I'm having trouble geographically putting certain things together because the witness who was the principal witness against Ed Johnson was working on a stone, I think they describe it as a stone church, and that is up behind what was then the Chattanooga Medicine Company and had to have been 300 or 400 yards from the gate to the cemetery. Am I putting things together incorrectly there?
He never said that he actually saw the attack. He just simply said that he saw Ed Johnson near the railway station that evening. So yeah, it was in a completely different place. So he wasn't saying that he was there where the attack was. He just said he was near the train station that night and saw Ed Johnson.
Right, right. Yeah, but my point is not that he saw Ed Johnson do it, but even being able to see Ed Johnson from that church, which, as I recall, is up on a hill and maybe 200 or 300 yards at, what, 6 o'clock at night, 5 o'clock at night? I got a little difficulty with that.
I think, obviously, his testimony definitely did not hold up to scrutiny. It was not scrutinized in court very much at all. But I think also, I don't remember exactly if he said, you know, that he had perhaps been walking.
He had said that he had seen somebody with a leather strap in the vicinity around 6 p.m. And then it was the sheriff, after looking for the assailant over the course of the next 3 days, one thing led to another, and that led to Ed Johnson. But no, Will Hixon was not a witness to the attack on Nevada Taylor.
I think he was quite vague in how and where he had seen Ed Johnson. Yeah, I don't think they had, you know, really scrutinized his testimony in that way in which you would think that a vigorous court case would.
To dial back to that night, a doctor soon arrived at the Taylor residence, examined her, confirmed that what happened to her happened to her. The sheriff asked her what she could remember of the attack. It lasted only 10 minutes. She was unconscious. She said she couldn't recall much. She told the sheriff that her attacker was a little below average height, had muscular arms, and wore a black outfit and a hat, and had what she called a soft, kind voice. Then the sheriff asked her, quote, was the man white or Negro? Taylor answered that she wasn't sure. She hadn't gotten a good look at him. Then she said she thought that he was black.
Yes, and this is something where, you know, you have to wonder how much her thinking, you know, was influenced by pressure from the sheriff, obviously wanting an accurate description of this man. And whether she, because she was very, very hesitant, and as we know later on in the trial, she did not identify him positively. And even when the sheriff later took her to Nashville and had Ed Johnson and another man speak, she said his voice was like that of Ed Johnson's. And so, you know, just from the very beginning, very hesitant, a very not a strong identification of her attacker, or after Ed Johnson was identified, that she felt confident that he was the man. But I'm sure under a lot of pressure, probably from her family and from the sheriff, to make some kind of identification or to give some kind of information so that they could begin the search.
And there was no dispute that she had been attacked. So her ability to recall and the pressure that you're talking about at the same time.
Yes, and I think that's one thing as we tell this story, you know, I think it's very important to note that there were definitely two victims in this story. I mean, probably more as well, but certainly Ed Johnson was a victim. But I do believe Nevada Taylor was a victim and was not necessarily trying to accuse someone, but was a young woman under a lot of pressure, and she had there's no doubt in the history, you know, the doctor's diagnosis that she had definitely suffered a terrible attack and had been raped.
As you say, there was pressure. And there was pressure not only for her to identify as best she could who her attacker was, there was pressure on the sheriff to make an arrest, to find the guilty person. The sheriff then, as the sheriff is now, is an elected position.
He was actually just facing re-election, right? So he actually had a fairly strong opponent at the time and, you know, well-known, well-respected man in town, but still no guarantee of an election. And certainly, and Judge Thomas, I'll let you speak to this some more, but certainly his re-election hinged on being able to solve this case.
I don't think there's any question about that. Because of currency. I mean, you've got a very high-profile case, and if he hadn't pressed forward to get it resolved and get it resolved in favor of the state, he would have faced a lot of criticism at that time, given the environment at that time, for not doing so.
And then over the course of the next 3 days, there was the search. There was the investigation of the crime scene that turned up a black leather strap that matched the red streaks around Nevada Taylor's neck. And then when we get to Thursday of that week, because what happened happened on a Monday evening, then we get to Will Hixon, who worked at a medicine company near the cemetery. He reported that he had seen a black man, quote, twirling a leather strap around his finger, unquote, shortly before 6 p.m. on the evening. Hixon calls the sheriff to say that he had just seen that same man walking north toward town with another man, both of these gentlemen black. The sheriff caught up with the other man and learned that his companion was Ed Johnson, sometimes Carpenter, known as a drifter. And then within hours on that Thursday, the sheriff spotted Johnson riding on the back of an ice wagon, and he was taken into custody. He was brought to the jail. He was identified by Hixon at that time as the man that he had seen with the strap by the station in St. Elmo. And then Hixon collected his reward of $375, and word spread like wildfire about the arrest.
I think it's important to note here that $375 was a lot of money in 1906, you know, a significant amount, and Hixon was not a wealthy man. It's also interesting to note that, you know, the word of this attack, as you noted, it happened on a Monday evening. By Tuesday, this had spread through the whole town, and yet Hixon waited until Thursday, when this reward kept growing and growing through the days as more people added money to it, you know, waited until Thursday to come out and sort of a convenient collection of memories and of sighting of Ed Johnson. So I think there's little doubt that Hixon certainly capitalized on the reward money and created this sighting of Ed Johnson that he had seen that night, and kind of took it from there. But yeah, once the wheels were in motion, once Ed Johnson was arrested, there was much less interest in finding evidence of his guilt than there was that they had somebody to answer for this.
In fact, that evening, that Thursday evening after his arrest, there came the crowd gathering in front of the Hamilton County Jail. A large crowd, many carrying guns, bullets fired into the sky. Nevada Taylor's younger brother giving a speech to the mob, quote, "The time for justice and punishment has come. We want the Negro. He must be punished for what he did to my sister." Then there was a demand from the mob to Captain George Brown, second in command of the jail. There would be 5 minutes for someone to turn over the keys, or there would be an assault on the jail. Leaders of the mob grabbed a steel post, began ramming it against the front door of the jail. Others in the mob took over the electric plant, throwing the jail into darkness. Men stole sledgehammers from a nearby blacksmith shop and started working on the hinges of the heavy door. The jail sustained a lot of damage from the attack. And if Ed Johnson had been in that jail that night, and if that mob had broken through, the lynching would have happened that night. But he wasn't there.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's really interesting, like you say, sort of the immediate call for justice. But, you know, actually also that's one thing that you see later on with Sheriff Shipp not keeping Johnson from the lynching crowd, but the sheriff did act like, you know, immediately after Johnson's arrest, I think being aware that Johnson was probably not safe in Chattanooga. And, you know, initially they had talked of taking him to Knoxville and actually even told the crowd that they had taken him to Knoxville. Judge Samuel McReynolds is the one that arrives on the scene and kind of talks the crowd down and tells them Johnson isn't in the jail, and then actually allows some of them to go inside and see that Johnson isn't there, but they had taken him to Nashville for safekeeping, you know, and he stayed there until his trial. And so they had acted, authorities had acted fairly quickly in that instance to keep him safe, just simply because they knew of what the mood was of Chattanooga at that time and the people in Chattanooga.
And then we come back to Nevada Taylor. She travels to Nashville the next day, identifies, though none too certainly, that Ed Johnson was her attacker. And that's also the same day that the judge convened a grand jury in the case. And now we come to the point, Neil, where your great uncle comes into the picture.
Right. Conscripted, so to speak. If you look at the timeline of this whole thing, which is what you've just done quite well, you've got a grand jury convened, an indictment returned, a trial held, a request for a transfer of the trial denied, and a conviction all within 30 days. That's unheard of. Does he want a trial and conviction?
Yes.
Because he got it. I mean, when you deny, given the fervor that was in Chattanooga, and I won't speak for what would happen today, but that's good grounds for a transfer, what's known as a transfer of venue, to get a crowd that is, or a jury, excuse me, that is not a crowd. And here you got a jury that was a crowd.
And the judge faced the same political pressure as the sheriff, which was find somebody, find the guilty person. And the judge appointed three local attorneys to represent Ed Johnson, one of whom was your great uncle.
And one of whom was a retired judge, which was thankfully good. And another was a practitioner. But even to have three counsel available to do the type of work that's necessary in a trial of that magnitude is just unheard of. And I think Uncle Will's letter to the public that was published the day after his conviction as the reason for not appealing says, you know, we were up till 3 o'clock in the morning every morning trying to prepare this case.
One evening when he managed to try to catch some sleep, he was awakened by the sound of rocks crashing through his windows.
Rocks and bricks.
Because they knew where he lived and they knew who he was defending and they weren't having it.
And not, especially not at that time.
The trial began Tuesday, February 6, 1906. Nevada Taylor was the first on the stand. The prosecutor asks her if the man who attacked her was present in the courtroom, and she says, I believe he is the man.
Not quite an identification, is it?
And then after testimony given by the doctor who examined Taylor, then the prosecutor, Matt Whitaker, calls Will Hixon to the stand. Hixon tells jurors that he saw the defendant with a strap in his hand near the scene of the crime. That is not as definitive as it might sound.
That's almost subject to exclusion as non-probative.
Hixon claimed that Johnson's face was illuminated by two electric cars passing Cemetery Station in the 6 p.m. hour before the attack. Quote, I saw his face well and could not be mistaken in it.
Now, if you couple that with something that very unusual that happened in that trial, and I'm not sure, Marianne, you may help me on this one. At some point in time, Uncle Will took the stand, which today would be prohibited under our ethics. You can't represent a party and be a witness at the same time. He took the stand and confronted Will Hixon and testified very graphically as he confronted Will that every time he said something, Will's head would get lower and lower and lower, you know, indicating that, yeah, you've got me lying here. That testimony was given to the jury.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really interesting as you look at this entire case, how much, you know, was allowed and granted 1906, you know, as Judge Thomas notes, the times were slightly different. There were different rules, but still so many things that just spoke to the unethical nature and the troublesome nature of what was allowed in testimony, and that this case was set up to have one conclusion from the very beginning, and it didn't really matter what was said or what was done. And, you know, with Judge Thomas's great uncle there, he tried, you know, he took the stand, he gave a very fervent closing argument, you know, which Judge Thomas can speak to too, but there was only one outcome, and that was that Ed Johnson was guilty because that had been decided from the beginning.
And of course, the sheriff took the stand for the prosecution. He testified that Johnson, quote, raised his voice to a higher pitch in an attempt to prevent Nevada Taylor from identifying him as the attacker when Nevada Taylor was brought to Nashville.
Highly suspect.
And even, you know, to identify Ed Johnson as just simply through a voice association like that, you know, and like even like as Judge Thomas noted when she said, I believe he is the man, was certainly not. And even when she identified him at the jail in Nashville, she said he sounds like the man. And so each time it was just such a hesitant, not clear identification that was, you know, pushed forward by the sheriff, pushed forward by the judge, by all the witnesses in the case.
When Ed Johnson testified, he swore that he had never seen Nevada Taylor before his arrest. He said he was at the Last Chance Saloon when she was assaulted, leaving the saloon only to fetch firewood, away for not enough time to commit the crime. He gave the names of men who could vouch for him at the saloon, and they did. When Ed Johnson was asked if he had assaulted Nevada Taylor, he said, quote, no, sir, I never done what they charged me with. If there's a God in heaven, I'm innocent. None of this mattered to the crowd in the Hamilton County courtroom. They hissed at him and heckled him. The jurors were all white and all male. At one point in the trial, a juror stood up and moved toward Johnson, saying, quote, if I could get at him, I would tear his heart out right now. The judge did not admonish him, and he remained on the jury.
It's been glossed over a little bit, but there was a witness who testified, and I was trying to think whether he was an alibi witness or whether he was a witness for the state. Marianne, John T. Lupton testified as to whether or not he was present in the Last Chance Saloon. And the connection, I guess you've got to know the history of Chattanooga about that time. The connection with John T. Lupton at that time, that was 1906. 1899, the first Coca-Cola bottling company had just been formed. Guess who the three shareholders were? Well, that was the two of them and plus John T. Lupton. Well, where did John T. Lupton get the seed money he needed for his investment in the Chattanooga Bottling Company? Which was $2,500, by the way. The total cost of that plant was $7,500. He got his investment money from the dowry given to him by his father-in-law, who was Patton of Chattanooga Medicine Company. So there's that. I don't know whether that means anything, but it all ties back into St. Elmo, Chattanooga Medicine Company, and the folks associated.
This is part of the story that we have to tell in order to take people back to that time and place. This wasn't just an event or a series of events that happened in isolation.
And it's interesting when you look at these last names in this case, and not so much necessarily, you know, like McReynolds and Shipp, you don't see that, but I know as I've done research on this story and kind of delved into, you know, newspaper articles and you're reading about people during that time, and there's these names that are now street names in Chattanooga, you know, and there's these, as you say, it's just so woven into the history of Chattanooga and the players, the people involved in this case, the people who had strong ties to Nashville and you know, the governor and people who had ties to the senators in D.C. and things like that. And these were the power players in Chattanooga. And these were the people that kind of stepped up and got involved in this case because they were so concerned about the appearance of having any negative press on Chattanooga. Chattanooga at that time, as Thomas noted, you know, the bottling company, Chattanooga Medicine, all these businesses were just really taking off. And the players in Chattanooga, the power brokers in Chattanooga, wanted to portray Chattanooga as this very progressive up-and-coming town that was welcoming to business. And this whole case, both, you know, Ed Johnson's criminal case, and they wanted to make it go away quickly. And then also, of course, when the lynching happened, they wanted to make that go away quickly so people would forget about it.
Marianne, you're right on, because in the decades from 1900 to 1910, the population of Chattanooga grew by 40%.
That's a lot of people coming into town in 10 years.
Correct. Correct. You can't have negative publicity and bring people in like that.
We are talking about the trial of Ed Johnson here in Chattanooga in 1906 with Marianne Martin of the Ed Johnson Project and Judge Neil Thomas, whose great uncle Will was one of Johnson's defense lawyers at that trial.
1906 was more than 40 years after the end of the Civil War. We're past Reconstruction. We are right in the middle of the Jim Crow era. Crow era of segregation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the case winding down because several things happened at the conclusion of that case, one of which was in Leroy's book, by the way, and let me give a plug for Leroy Phillips' book, Contempt of Court. That book itself took 40 years to prepare. He did such a thorough job of preparing the story of Ed Johnson, and he got the American Bar Association highest award for literature the year that it was published. But he did a very kind thing, I thought, in printing most of Uncle Will's closing argument, and he gave me a copy of the book, and I keep a mark on that point because in that closing argument for Ed Johnson, he really, after having had the stones and the bricks thrown through his window and representing Ed, came down to the closing argument, and he gave the lead off on the close, which is a little unusual given the experience of the other lawyers in the case on the defense side. But I want to read, because it means so much to me, I want to read a portion of that closing argument because he makes it very personal. He doesn't up front on this argument, he doesn't dwell on the facts. He makes it very personal by saying, in the face of 12 good men from my own home, all of whom I know, and most of whom I know intimately, I could not stand here and ask the acquittal of a man I believe to be guilty. My home is here. Every friend that has ever been a friend to me is here. My old mother lives now on Macaulay Avenue, and she is there while I am here talking to you. I have two sisters and three little nieces living in this city. I could not be so false to the womanhood dear to me and to the mothers, wives, and sisters dear to me as to stand here and ask you to acquit this man if there were any reasonable certainty of his guilt. If I could, I'd help you find the truth in this solemn hour. That's why I'm here. I want to help you. He puts it right on the line. And as a real estate lawyer, he probably knew a whole lot of people and some on the jury, because the firm represented a company called Chattanooga Estates Company, which was formed as part of a trust from England called the Waller Trust. Chattanooga Estates Company at one point in time owned almost all the land from roughly Red Bank to North Chattanooga. And so in dealing with the property in the city at that time, he put his personal name right on the defense of Ed Johnson. And for that, I'm extremely proud.
He took a risk in more ways than one.
Yeah. Now, one thing that is not in the materials that I saw, and it is in Leroy's book, I believe, when Judge McReynolds gave the case to the jury, the first night they deliberated until quite late, as I believe it was midnight, and they were hung 8-4. I don't think they were sequestered because the sheriff or someone from the sheriff's office asked for a list of jurors and their home addresses before the jury was excused that night. And the jury went home. I believe they went home because they weren't sequestered. And after having locked 8-4, came back the next morning and within 30 minutes returned a guilty verdict. One might wonder what the sheriff did with that list of jurors.
I think there's a lot of intriguing parts of this story, and you know, we're fortunate that we know a lot about this story because of the Supreme Court case and all the association with it. There's so many court documents, but just that one little nugget there, you know, of the request for the jurors' names and home addresses, and then that immediate returned the next morning to finding Ed Johnson guilty when the jurors had been hung, as says Chalmers' notes, for multiple hours. Like it as said, it was, I think it was midnight when they went home that night. And you just have to wonder, and I know as we've done research on this, you know, that we do hope that perhaps there might be letters. We've tried to, you know, find the, go through the jurors' names. If you know, if people have, and these once again are names common still in Chattanooga, but if people have diaries or journals, you have to wonder if one of those jurors might have wrote a letter or wrote something in a journal. It would just be so interesting to kind of crack that one mystery there. That is, the newspaper notes it very clearly. Like, I think it was probably something that was evident even to at that time that something strange had happened, but of course no details about what happened.
Now, the Supreme Court did send down U.S. Marshals to investigate it, and one would assume that they investigated that portion of it and didn't come up with anything, but then query, did they investigate that portion of it?
Well, and one thing that also is very interesting, as you say, with this investigation, you know, even various parts of, so one thing we have now been able to find, you know, that one published photo of Ed Johnson, but the newspapers talk about the many photos that were taken of him in the days that he was in the jail, and people would come down and stand with him, of him inside the bars and take photos with him. And we have never been able to find any of those photos. And one of our thoughts is that perhaps when the federal agents arrived in Chattanooga, suddenly this was something that no one wanted to be involved with or know anything. So we wonder if people at that time maybe even quickly destroyed evidence just because they didn't want to be caught up in what was now a federal criminal investigation.
It's so total that it raises that very question.
Well, and I think that's right to observe that, because if you look at the furor in Chattanooga when the Supreme Court agreed to take the case, it was, how dare you step into something that is a state's rights issue? And if you couple that with the thousands that greeted Sheriff Shipp after he returned from serving his prison term after having been found in contempt of the United States Supreme Court, that thousands of people would greet him at the train station, I think it's a pretty good indication of what the mood of Chattanooga was at the time. I think Marianne's correct.
And then we need to come back to the verdict. And a split, another split in this case, among the defense attorneys about whether to appeal the conviction. Tell us more about that.
It was 2-1. Unfortunately, Uncle Will, this is not the decision that I'm really proudest of Uncle Will on, because he was on the side of, I guess you'd call it a practical recommendation, and that is, Ed, you can either appeal it and get lynched now, or, because I don't think there are any good grounds for appeal, you'll be hung afterwards. That's really not any kind of good option. And I know that Judge Cameron was the one who said, we think we should appeal it. But that's what the decision was, and what they did on whether or not to appeal it was to ask for the appointment of three other lawyers to meet with them on that afternoon of the day of the conviction. I mean, they met immediately, so that six lawyers assessed whether or not the appeal should go forward, and the vote was not to proceed with the appeal, that there were not grounds. And I think today's audience would say, you've got to be kidding me. There are grounds and grounds and grounds. But at the time, the question was, under state law, whether or not he had received a fair trial. In today's jurisprudence, the Supreme Court would have had an opportunity to intervene to determine whether or not that was a fair trial. But at that time, the jurisprudence was that the Supreme Court was hands-off on whether state courts were affording fair trials to defendants, that the Constitution did not reach that far. So the decision was made not to appeal, and then that's when Noah comes in and the habeas corpus proceeding in Knoxville.
We're talking about Noah Pardon, the leading African-American attorney in Chattanooga at that time, and law partner of Stiles L. Hutchins.
For the sake of your audience, Ray, the habeas corpus, this was one of the very first times, if not the first time, that type of proceeding was used to federal court intervene in state court criminal proceedings on whether or not the trial was fair. And the judge, that hearing was held in Knoxville. The judge there said, no, I'm not going to use the habeas corpus procedure to review whether or not this trial was fair. And that's what led Noah on the train to Washington, where he was lucky enough to get probably the best justice he could have had, Justice Harlan, review the petition for a writ of certiorari, which is a request to the Supreme Court to review the case. I know our Supreme Court right now has been under a lot of scrutiny on requests to review, but a precious few, even then, of the cases that they were asked to review were granted review rights before the United States Supreme Court, but Justice Harlan granted that, and that's what led to the contempt of the sheriff, because he remanded Ed Johnson to the safekeeping and custody of Sheriff Shipp pending review of the case by the United States Supreme Court.
When your great uncle told Ed Johnson that his choice was either to accept the verdict or die in a quote-unquote orderly way at an appointed time, or to die at the hands of the mob, Ed Johnson reportedly told your great uncle, quote, "I will tell the judge I am ready to die, but I will also say I am not the guilty man.
I am an innocent man." I think that's what he said when he was lynched.
Yes. And once again, kind of circling back to, we talked about the pressure on Nevada Taylor, right? And you have to think about the pressure on Ed Johnson here. He has a fourth grade education, of course, a African-American man at that time, you know, already having much less privilege than a white person. But just this young man in this completely unknown, just doesn't know what the situation is, and these white men telling him what he should do. And obviously he doesn't want to die in a lynching. And so he has no good options and chooses the options that he thinks is the best. But throughout, it doesn't matter in what circumstance, it doesn't matter how much pressure he's under, even as he's on that bridge about to die, he continues to say, "I am innocent, I am innocent, I did not do this." You just have to believe him, absolutely, because how many people have confessed even falsely to things they did under that kind of pressure? But that was the one thing that he absolutely knew, that he had not done this, and that he was dying an innocent man.
That's correct.
One of you has grown up with this case, and the other came to this case a little later on in life. But I want each of you to share what this case means to you, what you think it means to this community all these years later.
That's a really good question. And as you note, I did come to this case late. I did not grow up in Chattanooga. I moved there as an adult for a job there, actually at the Times Free Press, and grew to love the city, and still, you know, it's always going to hold a place in my heart. But it's just like, as I found this case after I moved to Chattanooga, read the book, began doing research, it's just such a story of men, good men, Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins, who were willing to put their lives on the line to do what they knew was right. They knew Ed Johnson was innocent, and they knew he had not been given a fair trial. And it didn't matter if they died to defend that right and to do what they had to. Just kind of that testimony that speaks today to everybody. And also the men who were not willing to do what was right. You talk about the lynchers, but you also talk about the judge who watched that night as the lynchers from the courthouse and did nothing to stop them, and just had no interest in standing up for the right of a man's life. And that brings us to today. And we are faced every day with decisions where we can do easy things and we can hide in courtrooms and peer out the windows, or we can stand on the front lines and make the right decision. I think this is just, to me, it's a personal, yes, it's a historical case. Yes, it matters in courtrooms even today, this U.S. Supreme Court decision. But to me, it's just such a personal story as well that still echoes in the streets of Chattanooga and the bridge. And there's just so many reminders everywhere you walk in Chattanooga about this case and about choosing the right thing and doing the hard thing, even if it means your life is on the line.
Well said. That really is. And let me just add a little footnote, personal footnote on this in terms of, Ray, you said, having grown up here and having that blood, there's additional blood that flows in me. And this has not been brought out before, but at the same time this trial was proceeding in criminal court, upstairs there was another man who was presiding in circuit court on the civil side. This was a circuit court on the criminal side, but the man upstairs who served from 1903 to 1912 as circuit court judge in Hamilton County had a daughter who married the nephew of Uncle Will, Judge M.M. Allison. And Judge Allison's daughter married Will's Uncle Will's nephew, who is my grandfather. So there is a lot of blood that runs in me that says, when I often look at a case and evaluate it, it's awful easy without jurisprudence to have the reaction and say, this just ain't right. And then go to the books from there to see if my gut reaction is a correct one. But I can't, I've got a case right now where it's a pro bono case dedicated to Uncle Will, I suppose, where my reaction when the client came in, I said, this just ain't right. It's not supposed to be. And we've been working on that case for 2 years now. Hopefully we'll see a good resolution to it. But Uncle Will dedicated his life to things that just ain't right. Judge Allison did the same thing. Judge Allison left the bench because he couldn't make enough money to support a family. But he went on as one of his public projects to be the founder and sole president of the Dixie Highway Association, which was the first interstate highway from Michigan to Miami. So I guess I got volunteer blood in me. That's the reason we're here in Tennessee.
It all comes back around again.
Yes.
All right. Mary Ann, Neil, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And now, a preview of part two of the Ed Johnson Conversations with Catherine McCauley Gardner and Ardina Garth Hicks on the appeal for Ed Johnson that made its way to the United States Supreme Court.
The afternoon of February 8th, Skinbone Johnson, who was Ed Johnson's father, went to Noah Pardon to ask him to take the appeal. The story is that Noah Pardon and Skinbone Johnson were in one room, one office, talking about the appeal. Pardon was reluctant. He understood that this would jeopardize his practice. If he took the appeal, he would make the judge that he has to come before all the time very angry. He knew that would make it very difficult for him to successfully pursue his cases in that court. He was very reluctant to do it, but sitting in the next room listening was Stiles Hutchins, his partner, who was about a little more than 10 years older than him, had a history of pursuing civil rights cases. He had sued the city of Chattanooga for not allowing Black children to attend city summer activities. He had served in the Tennessee state legislature for 2 years during Reconstruction and had been successful in getting a poll tax, a Chattanooga poll tax reversed. He felt like it was civil rights now for his people. And so he went to Noah Pardon and said, we've got to take this case. We've got to take this case. To whom much is given, much is expected. And Noah Pardon agreed to take the case.
And Noah Pardon, during the trial, did provide assistance to those three white lawyers. He was asked to help defend Ed Johnson. He declined to do that for all the reasons that you just said, Catherine, but he had traded notes with one of the white lawyers at the trial. He had helped the defense locate witnesses for Johnson's alibi. So he was involved in the case in that trial, but now he had a decision to make about whether to go public and along with Stiles Hutchins to make that appeal.
Yes, and one of the things that is really powerful when you do study what happened, and I got to see a lot of this when I was in the public defender's office, is that, yes, the choice you make when your livelihood is lost sometimes depends upon the judge's attitude or concern for you. And one of the things about appellate practice is that it was meant to be an oversight. And when the public defender system was created here in Hamilton County in 1990, there was a lot of power in the fact that my clients were the people that I represented. And no matter who was on the bench, the bottom line was the choices that I made were the choices that I made for the client and also to the people who elected me, because Tennessee was one of the few places that had elected public defenders. So therefore, it was really, really powerful, because now not only was he dealing with reputation, but I'm sure he was also dealing with finances, because just getting to where you had to go. I mean, we're looking at the benefits of electronics and computers and all of these things now. Can you imagine that? His brief had to be handwritten by somebody who wrote well. And so just that power in the preparation was just not, you handed it off to somebody and they took care of it. I'm sure he did a lot of that himself.
Our thanks to Mary Ann Martin, Judge Neil Thomas, the members of the Ed Johnson Project, and to Tony R. Smith Sr., Willie Kitchens, and their fellow musicians for I Am an Innocent Man, the Ed Johnson song. Visit the Ed Johnson Project at its website, edjohnsonproject.com, and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. Thank you.